Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
All righty, good evening and welcome to my office here at Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital, right here in the beautiful city of Houston, Texas. And we are not live tonight. We are pre-recording. And every time, just to kind of let you know the news, every time we do a pre-record, that means we have some of the very, very special guests that I'm excited about still from having on a few weeks ago. We just kind of started our conversation. We have become great friends, and we want to dig into some deeper thoughts and some categories and topics with our conversation. And we're going to bring her on here just in a second. So tonight, if you want to make comments, you're welcome to do that. But do that through the Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page, or you can text me at 832-396-6525. But we will not be taking live phone calls this evening, but we will pick back up on that next week. So I hope everything's going well with you. Been a long week or two here in Houston, but things are going good. I'm back up and running, and we're just going crazy. Matter of fact, I'm going to be, I'm going to be in San Antonio Monday noon doing a kickoff for a month of trauma-informed care awareness for the university health systems, and looking forward to that. So that's going to be, I'll be up there in San Antonio. That is probably next Wednesday. So May 1st, would love to see people there, or you can join online, and we're going to talk about trauma-informed sensitivity care. And I believe my talk that day is on discovering resiliency during your darkest hour. Wow, I hope that's good. I haven't written that yet, but no, I have. But that's going to be awesome. May 1st, live in San Antonio. So we'd love to have you there. We're going to go right into our program today and just right into our guests. I'd like to go ahead and have TJ, if you could, bring on in Ina Lucia Mariaca Pacheco. And she is a new friend of mine. And Ina Lucia was on a few weeks ago. And she is a trauma-informed professional specialized in child sexual abuse, exploitation, and trafficking. She has two different bachelor's degrees from the University of Ottawa in Canada, a master's degree in human security from the Royal Roads University in Canada. And for over a decade, she has worked with the government of Canada, non-government organizations, international organizations, and Interpol, law enforcement, and live experts on research. And as a matter of fact, she has research that is right here that I have read every page of that is absolutely unbelievable research with men and boys. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. But we're also going to talk on a couple of new topics. And then we're going to talk about this conference that's coming up in Miami, Florida. And I just want to welcome Ina Lucia back to the program. And Ina, I tell you, we have had so much response still from text, emails, and people that have reached out and said, wow, you got to have her back on soon. And we were already talking about having you back. So welcome to the program. And thank you for sharing some time with us. And you're over in France right now. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Gregory Williams, for having me back today. I'm so excited to be here. And yes, still over here in France. And thank you for making the time for this pre-recorded session today. But yeah, I am so excited to be here and to get into our conversation for today.
Well, I tell you, your work with men and boys is so important, and it seems like, matter of fact, I think this is a good thing. Every day for the month of May, they have a different speaker at this university hospital system in San Antonio, and I believe I'm only one of maybe two of the 30 speakers that's male. What in the world is going on in the world that causes us to not want to take a step into the darkness of what is happening to men, what is happening to boys, and why do we stray away from that?
Yeah, that is a great question and a good thing to look in internally as a collective, as a society, on why we don't want to share, for example, victimhood. That was a big part of my study, actually, was who do we see as victims versus who do we see as perpetrators, and which will lead just naturally into this conversation today about female perpetration. But unfortunately, especially when it comes to sex crimes, the very general way of contextualizing the situation or the crime is really gender biased. So it's very female victim focused and very male perpetrator focused and heavy as well. And so when we start bringing into conversations, like other genders, for example, or even the idea of a male victim, it really shakes up the room and it really shakes up the conversation, because even though we have it documented that it's true and it happens, it really takes a societal shift to move away from those very big blinders that we have on what we want to accept as a society, and what we want to react to, for example. So when it comes to these conferences and meetings where there is a big gender disparity when it comes to survivors telling their story, I have noticed that quite a bit. But the one positive thing that I will say about it is at least they're starting to be brought into the conversation. This raising awareness for it and starting to bring in male survivors to say their story is a really big shift change already. And so I'm really hoping that through in society we will see more and more balance in these stories that come up. But as I am very well aware of, and there should be a lot of attention on female victimization, but it should start to become more of a shared space where no matter what gender you are, belief, ethnicity, age, that you are believed and that your story is valued as well. And so hopefully there is a shift change in the future, but I have seen that quite a bit in the past. And there can be survivor story competitiveness, unfortunately. That is something that is very prevalent in the space on who can claim survivorhood and whose story is more traumatic than another. And that's a very unhealthy way to go about it. Unfortunately, that is in the space. But hopefully, as we progress forward as a society together and start sharing these spaces and sharing that sexual violence is a non-gendered issue, hopefully we can see kind of more stories and balance coming through.
Is the issue the fact that men and boys have their emotional door locked a little tighter than women, or the fact that the world isn't as open to hear from men and boys, or were not even aware that they could be victims? Or is it just a little piece of all of that?
I think you answered your own question. I think it is a piece of all of that and all of those certain things is that men and boys usually don't even identify as victims, depending on their perpetrator or the situation or dissociation or how they process their own trauma. They might not see themselves as victims. They also probably may not come forward and bring it up because in society there's so many barriers for men, whether it's even being believed if they had it brought up, or being seen as less masculine, less manly, less valued. There's a very big toxic masculine component to this, and where both female and males kind of go into that more, and letting kind of forcing men to put that wall up of if they do come forward and are vulnerable and sensitive and even cry, let's say, that would be put off a lot of people. And why are you doing that? You should be stronger and man up. But in a society where this is the case, I'm glad we have more of these spaces where we're saying, actually, let's change that narrative. Let's allow these conversations to happen, because it's happening to any gender, to any age. It doesn't really matter who the victim is in that kind of a sense, that it could happen to anyone. And so we should kind of allow for these conversations. But it has been a lot more easier for females to come forward and have their story. It in itself, it is a hard situation of potential disbelief, a lot of trauma that you have to go through. So I'm not putting any female victims or survivors down when I say that, but I'm just saying that men and boys also have that additional barrier that women don't particularly have to face, of female perpetration being involved, of would you even be believed, of the masculinity aspect of it, because we are allowed to be a little bit more sensitive and emotional. So with all those varying factors, I can see why a lot of men don't bring up their story or speak about their story.
I was contacted by a corporation to write a book, and hired to do that. And I did that, called Hiding in the Darkness, about men and boys. And I wrote the book, sent it to the hospital system that this corporation sponsors. And as I was doing research for my own book, I started going into all these websites that were supposedly for men and boys to get resources. And I was totally shocked and appalled that probably 75% of them have flowers, pink and mauve pages. And it's like, wait, this is supposed to be for men. What's all the flowers doing around in the templates of the web page? None of it made sense to me. I would make it more manly, more masculine. And it was just like we've taken women's templates and just changed, added men in place of the women, and it didn't address the real issues. And I was really shocked that there's not that much material out there for us to be able to pull good, solid resources from. And that's why I was so excited about your work, because it's groundbreaking what you've done.
Thank you. No, I really do appreciate that, and I have definitely noticed that aspect. It's all around the world. There's this very gendered approach to healing, therapy, support. It is very feminized, and so, for example, you go into a safe room, it might be pink, there might be stuffed animals, there might be more feminine tweaks and parts to the room. And so a lot of the male survivors that did come forward with their stories, they did mention that on this very gendered way the posters or the websites are, and they then don't self-identify as a victim because they don't look like the victim. And that is a massive thing for both trafficking and abuse survivors, because, for example, when they see those posters and it's a small girl with the chains on her, and very like the movie Taken in the media, it's very feminized. And so by doing that, like we had just spoken about, male survivors of whatever crime that is, they don't self-identify, and they will walk away from those support services because they go, oh, that's not for me, or I don't identify as that, or I don't see myself like they would, even if they go through, let's say, the exact same type of abuse, because of how it is portrayed in the media, and portrayed by society. There is that, that factor, and that is definitely something for us as frontline service providers to take into account. For example, the room should be more neutral, the color should be more neutral, the wording should be changed a little bit. Instead of internally emotional focus, it could be more action-based wording. And so it's like looking at these tailored approaches. We do need to customize and tailor everything we do to men and boys, and then even more particular to their certain cultural group, their
Yeah.
age, their ethnicity, even their religious beliefs. It can go even more tailored to that. And it's so important to have those on your team, let's say your support team, whether it's a therapist, a counselor, a friend, that they go along with you on this healing journey, but they also match those pieces of you that need that healing in that particular point. So, for example, a Latino or someone with Asian background will have certain cultural barriers that will be different than a typical Caucasian male would go through. For example, the idea of dishonoring the family for both male and female is a very massive factor for a lot of immigrant families. And so disclosure just on that alone will not happen because it will bring a huge dishonor to the entire family, to the mom, to the dad. And then that could either cause the family to disown them and cut them off, or and no one speaking to them again. And so like there's different barriers for different types of backgrounds. So that's also something that's really important to look into as well.
You know, I think one of the reasons that my speaking calendar's booked so tight isn't because I'm such a good speaker, but it's because I go in with a suit and tie, professional, medical education background, and I'm different looking than what they perceived as being a victim. And then they say, "Oh, you're just going to talk about it." Well, no, this is what it looks like. And people go, "Whoa, wait, you look like a normal person." Absolutely. People with briefcases and ties and suits that are out there that's in their 40s, 50s, and 60s are the ones that we need to be reaching, because I think that's a whole generation that has been overlooked, that because we don't look like what is being portrayed as being, like you said, being handcuffed and dragged off and kidnapped in a dirty white van in a park. It's stuff that's happening in neighborhoods that are upper middle class, and we need to address those folks because they're screaming for help and they can't find any.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you did your research, how many was involved in all the surveys that you've done in that?
So in the first study, I had 40 male survivors,
40.
or identified as male, and about 30 field experts. So these would be people that have worked with male victims and survivors for at least a minimum of 3 years plus. And so with those 30 experts, it ranged from psychologists, law enforcement, medical staff. I even had a former human trafficker as well on that. So it's a really kind of holistic way on viewing male victimization. And then in the second study, when it was on human trafficking done by the family, that was 10 survivors that were taken from the original group of 40 that had similarities in their cases and their stories, so that we can build parallels and patterns. And then that is really where the inspiration for this new study came into. So going off of the two academic works, The Needs and Stories of Male Survivors, as well as She Was Willing to Send Me There, which is the journal article, this really led to the key findings that constantly kept pointing at female perpetrators. And so, with these findings and this research, I really wanted to analyze these profiles and discover really what was a female perpetrator and what was so different than what we're told by media and society today. So, for example, the presence of female perpetrators was nearly universal in some of the studies I did. So, when reviewing the child sexual abuse, the female perpetrators were in 60% of those 40 cases. When we were looking at just the trafficking cases, aside from the ones that were only sexually abused, 10 out of the 12 participants reported that women were either their traffickers or sexually abused them, with 6%, I mean, with 6 of the participants reporting that it was their mothers that was the leading perpetrator in their trafficking. So when evaluating the human trafficking cases done by the families, the female perpetrators, which were moms, that jumped up to 90%. So 90% of those cases were female perpetrators as the abusers, the exploiters, or the traffickers. And so this finding really made me realize that the majority of abuse really had to come close to someone. So it was either the moms, the grandmas, the aunts, the sisters. And so these profiles should really not be overlooked as potential perpetrators in the future, with moms coming in at the highest percentage for all of the cases in general. And it was just really interesting because I really wanted to look into this and see, well, if this is happening, which it is, we have survivor cases, why isn't this being spoken about or why
Right.
isn't this being studied? And we actually found that in 1894, there was a doctor named Richard von Krafft-Ebing. He was a German psychiatrist, and he actually wrote the first comprehensive examination of sexual disorders. And so he cites in his book, Psychopathic Sexualis, that there was a female servant that sexually assaulted children in her care. And one female was at the age of 7, and then there was a young baby boy at the age of 2. And so this is really the first instances of finding assault and sexual assault cases and sadism in these type of cases. And this was in 1894, and this was recorded. And when we start looking into law enforcement cases and studies, the FBI released a study by Langing and Burgess in 1984, and they reported a woman-led sex trafficking ring. So we can see that in these reports throughout history, we do have that knowledge that women are sexually abusing and trafficking. And so we're looking into like why are women offending? And so the research was showing some repeated themes. It could be their own sexual abuse trauma from their past. So for an example, there was a study by Tozen last year, which interviewed incarcerated female offenders, and he noticed that they would state that their sexual interest was innate or that they were born this way. So we can see that it's a little similar to male perpetrators when they kind of have these excuses of why they could have offended. But then other themes are, for example, they were coerced by male offenders, pressured by partners, or because they're cognitively impaired. But the studies that I'm seeing and I'm kind of uncovering is that there are a lot of females leading this and doing this out of their own actions. They're not being coerced by anyone, and they're the ones primarily benefiting from the abuse or the trafficking or the exploitation financially through in kind or for their own sadistic pleasure, let's say. And so a lot of these ideas of women being so delicate and sensitive, and how could we, you know, like we're the victims. These studies really show that a change in that shift of what we want to put on them contextually and saying, oh, women are these sensitive mothering creatures, is really just our own cognitive bias on what we want a mother to be like and what we
Right.
hope a mother to be like. And so if we look at some like official crime statistics, female offenders are actually quite low, around 1 to 12%, depending on the type of methodology of the data collected. But how can we really look at this without convictions? The official statistics really never show the real situation. So based on the number 12%, we would assume that these cases are very rare. But looking at other sources, for example, surveying survivors through research like this, we really see that the familial members are the perpetrators, and they're really using cultural and internal barriers of non-disclosure to really make sure the victim doesn't disclose. And so, even though the sample sizes for some of this research aren't so large for these smaller studies, we can see that there's kind of a general idea showing that in these smaller studies, survivors are reporting that this is happening to them at a 60%, 80%, 90% rate instead of that 1 to 12%. So we can't say that that this is the prevalence rate, of course not, but there is a correlation with high perpetration rates and these survivor accounts. So we should see that there is a clear discrepancy on how female perpetrations in the official crime statistics versus what is actually being not maybe officially documented, but at least disclosed by victims.
Are we
And
noticing in the media that recently, maybe in the last year or two, that it seems like those that are being arrested, being caught, being found out about online or trafficking and things of that order seems to be, you see a lot of, you just type it in right now in the internet, a lot of mugshots of people that are being arrested, even teachers at schools and owners of daycare centers. Predominantly, they're female.
Yeah, I wanted to definitely touch upon that. So, as you know me, a little researcher, I love looking into what's currently going on, how can we really analyze this? And I saw that there was just in the last 3 weeks, two really big cases in Houston, Texas area.
Yes.
Just in the area nearby. And so we have one case of a female teacher that has been caught sexually assaulting over a dozen boys. She purchased vapes for them, got them intoxicated, and then sexually assaulted them. And then a second case of a high school teacher that was helping her son recruiting troubled young ladies, offering them a place to stay, and this place to stay just happened to be a paid hotel from her. And so this Houston area high school teacher has been accused of helping her adult son to recruit like 16, 17-year-olds. But when you really look into it, her adult son, quote unquote, is actually only 22 years old. She's 42. She's been charged with felony sex trafficking and compelling prostitution, but her 22-year-old son is getting three times the count for each of those charges, and she has already posted bail and is out. So we can see so like easily that there is such a discrepancy between a female offender and a male offender, even though she was helping her son. She's double the age of him. She clearly knows what's going on. She's not just coerced by her adult 22-year-old. And her being put in this place, she most likely had paid for it. She knew what was happening to the girls. And so this whole situation where her son is getting three times what she's getting, she's already out. We can clearly see that there is an unfair aspect of this. And so this really leads to the realization that many female perpetrators never get caught, convicted, face any consequences within our judicial systems for these crimes. And most of these crimes are not even considered molestations or child abuse or rape, but kind of like a rite of passage for these adolescent males. As a result, these sex offenders are getting very short jail sentences for the same crimes that their male counterparts are committing. And this is really due to that gender bias. So as we can see here in the media and in these news reports, there is a lot more sympathetic language to female perpetrators. It's a lot of rites of passage and it not being seen as such a bad a thing. And I have a quote that just came to mind from a male survivor from my study, and he had said, "Females are just as manipulative and abusive as male perpetrators. Many times there are more because they're less likely to be prosecuted. Society does not want to look at a female perpetrator, especially if she is attractive. The old fantasy of a sexy teacher keeping her male students after school is embedded in our male-dominated society. We had a female substitute teacher engage in sexual relationships with three sophomore male students. An investigation was brought against the female teacher because several female students overheard the males bragging. The boy's parents wrote a letter in her defense because she helped make the boy into a man. The substitute teacher only had to pay a fine and was released." So, as we can see in that quote from a male survivor, this is still happening today and at the same kind of extent. A lot of female teachers are just getting away with it, and it's called a relationship or something that, we had that was special together. Whereas if we were to just to change it up and put a male teacher and a female student, this would be all over the news. He would go, have a larger prison sentence, and then actual like a very high bail amount. And so we can see that there is definitely a big discrepancy in there. And on top of this, with this whole rite of passage, a lot of male survivors will think that their experience is really kind of, like I said, this rite of passage, this I'm becoming a man. And so then this abuse internalized becomes, I can't feel sad about this. I can't be mad about this because I wanted it, or I should want it, or an older woman doing anything sexual with me is no longer seen as abuse or rape, let's say, but more of this right, an honor badge or something that a lot of young men would wear. But in reality, if a lot of men think back about their sexual experiences before they were 14, let's say, that's not consent. And so I talked to a lot of these men later on when I was going over the research, and today they have a lot of these, "Am I allowed to feel this way? Can I feel like that was uncomfortable, or that what had happened to me with the babysitter or with the teacher wasn't right, or with that older woman when I was a teenager wasn't right?" And it's interesting because a lot of the times they might disclose to their partners or their friends, and the friends will say, "Oh, great job, you got it, and you're a man now." Whereas a female, a female that also is potentially a survivor may then throw a comparison saying, "Oh, well, my experience was more traumatic than yours," which is actually quite common to happen as well. This comparison and competition of trauma, when in reality, a disclosure should just be seen as a disclosure and not as an act of competition. But "I'm sorry this also happened to you. Like, let me listen to you. How can I help and support you?" would be a better way to go about it. But we can definitely see in the literature and in media that a lot of these cases are letting them conceal and manipulate their way out of prosecution. And it's quite difficult to identify women because they hold this accepted dominant role over children as their caregivers, for example. So they can really leverage that and exploit a child very early on. And so another example why men might also feel like they struggle to identify themselves is especially if they perceived any part of their abuse as enjoyable or pleasurable. This will really make them not disclose if they're a man, especially because, or a woman, because they might think that Oh, I shouldn't have enjoyed it. And if I did enjoy it, then I must have consented to it, even if they were a child at the time. But in reality, a lot of what happens is just what automatically happens to the body when put in a arousing state. And so that doesn't have a connection between consent and wanting and what the body reacts to. So that's really kind of important to also look over and think about.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a real quick commercial break. The hours go by so fast. I want to talk about on the other side of the break, Lucia, the different categories of female perpetrators. And from what I've been looking at, and you probably have way more wisdom on it, that there's could be three different categories of those perpetrators that are female. And I want to see what you think of those. And those came out from a Psychology Today magazine article in January. That I just wanted to throw out at you, then get your response and get your true wisdom of what you've been in the trenches talking about this and finding out about it. So I want to get your insight on it right after this real quick commercial break. Hang with us. We'll be right back.
HCI Publishing that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back. I'm looking over just a couple articles that I printed off from the internet just before we got on the program today. Both of them are from Psychology Today. One's called Child Sexual Abuse by Female Perpetrators, and the other is The Last Taboo of Female Sexual Abuse of Children. And this one article talked about the categories of female abusers, and I'm trying to stay at a level to where I don't get emotionally tangled in this conversation. But as I was thinking about what happened to me, I do shun off that on those Monday evenings for 3.5 years where my bedroom door was being used to be trafficked of me, that probably 50% of those people that walked into the room were female, some with their boyfriends, some with their girlfriends, some alone. And as I think about it, the pain involved was more with the female than it was the male, believe it or not. How does that compare to anything that you heard in your interviews? But it seemed like I hate to say evil, but the anger, the cruelty was at a different level when it was a female perpetrator. Am I completely off base with that, or is that just my own experience?
No, you're not, Gregory. And thank you for opening up and sharing a little bit more of your story with me and with the audience. And I actually found that quite prevalent in the study as well. A lot of the times, women in other studies have been seen as playing these supportive roles, and not really being embedded within the sexual activity, but more as kind of supporting or helping the men in their lives do this, more passive or a failure to protect their own children. And these assertions actually were strikingly contrast with my personal study on male victims, where women were displaying a very diverse range of severity of violence, with increasingly higher levels of physical and sadistic abusive behavior. Many of the male survivors that opened up about their trafficking said that some females were caring and nurturing, but in the way of grooming. So, for example, it was like, let me clean you up and help you before you get abused again. It wasn't so much of a, oh no, you're suffering, let me help you, let me be there for you, let me hold you. It was more of a getting them ready for just the next part. But this nurturing, caring side, I think, just makes the manipulation a little bit easier to do for them, as and for the victim to take, because they think they're receiving a glimpse of care or love or something like that. And of course, a child or a person in such a vulnerable state, they're going to want whatever affection they kind of can get. And so some females did that, but a lot of the others were very sadistic and took what I would say as an enjoyment in causing pain and suffering to a lot of to a lot of their victims, regardless of it being male or female. I had a case where, trigger warning for your audience, but where a lot of these female perpetrators were extremely sadistic, whether it's putting the children in cages, dog collars, shock collars, putting them into freezers, like anything that is to such a form of sadism, even to the point of a child's death. And so we can't say that only men can be this violent and this sadistic. But I noticed that a lot of our female cases, there is a lot more mental manipulation, a lot more emotional manipulation. They use kind of grooming quite earlier on so that their child, or that the child, is kind of groomed to see themselves as a sex object and just kind of go along with what they think is what is normal. And a lot of the times, these women will also kind of use terminology to make a child not be able to disclose and not be believed. So, for example, they'll use the time of like playtime or love. And so when someone discloses using those type of terminology, they won't be believed. So a male survivor disclosed that his mother would say, it's time to have a dream, but it was right before she sexually abused him. So when he told his kindergarten teacher, I had a dream that this happened to me, his claims were immediately dismissed. So a lot of these like female perpetrators will kind of use this language, this manipulation, to not only groom the child to not disclose, but then groom the child to, when they do disclose, they're not believed because they're always playing these mind games and this manipulation. And if it is a mother in these kind of cases, they're really playing on the not only the grooming process, but they're creating this trauma bond from the start. And a lot of these cases, when I had a female perpetrator, it seems like a lot, they have a lot more male victims than female victims when it comes to female perpetration. That seems quite interesting. I didn't know that before going into these studies, but they are quite sadistic. And it was a big shock for me because coming into this, I was quite a feminist, and I wrote that in my thesis, actually, this bias that I had to make sure I did not add into the research in terms of protecting women, because I had this point of view of we're caring, we're nurturing, a mother would never. And then when I saw the rising amount of cases with more women and looking into it, I realized what our narrative is in society and what the reality is very different. And it's so important that we kind of finally bring these cases up, because it not only validates the story of so many male victims, but also female victims, for regardless of whatever gender had them as perpetrators, and are often not believed because they have these female perpetrators. An example I had that was very predominant to me was I had a Canadian case where, as a child, they were constantly disclosing to law enforcement, medical staff, to their teachers about these situations. But because of the terminology that I had a dream, the love, and other things, they weren't believed. No matter how many times they disclosed, they just weren't believed. When they went as an adult to the federal police, they disclosed, when I was a child, I was trafficked by my mother. I was also trafficked by an elderly couple, so male and female in their 70s, trafficking this child, this boy child. And to this officer, they said, "I don't believe you because that does not match our female perpetration statistics. If it was the female perpetrator, why has she not come in and disclosed her perpetration?" Which, as someone that has worked in this field a lot, I do not know of one pedophile that has willingly come forward and said, "Look at me, look what I've done, please put me in jail." That is not the reality of the case. And it's more likely that we're just not collecting those statistics, or we have these gender bias blinders on, which is more likely than a whole gender just not perpetrating. And
Wow.
so it was very interesting to hear that case. And I use that example quite a bit when I'm doing law enforcement training, to really show them how can we learn from this and do better for not only male survivors, but females as well, because this will affect anyone. And so it's so important to bring awareness to this for all of those cases that just haven't been believed in the past.
Yeah, I'm sitting here, my mind's just flashing back unbelievably. I remember probably the most painful experience I had is when two females were in my room on that Monday night when I was being sold, and I knew both of them because they were friends of my mom and dad's, and they came to the get-togethers they had all the time. And I was aware of them. But when they walked in that first time, it was a completely different look that I, and they took, I had baseball bats that were small giveaways at St. Louis Cardinal ball games. And there were two of my prized possessions. One was Bob Gibson, one was Lou Brock from the St. Louis Cardinals. And they took those two miniature baseball bats and did horrific things with them to me. And I, not only the physical pain, but I ended up burning those in the trash can the next afternoon just to get rid of my collectibles because of what they took off my bookcase shelf and said, hey, let's use these. And it was just horrific. And I never had a male do any of that like that to me. And it was like, oh, let's try this. And the mindset was at a deeper, manipulative and painful arena than what I ever experienced, before. And it didn't seem to care if there was pain involved. Matter of fact, that's what they were after. And I never seen that before.
That's what also shocked me to the point of nausea with studies like this. It's so hard to research female perpetration because of how dark it can get. But at the same time, it's so important because who is looking? We need these stories to be brought to light, and it's not fair for one gender to only be the perpetrators and one gender to only be the victims, and for there not to be any overlap. And so it's so important to bring these conversations to light, which thank you so much for doing today, and for raising awareness on this. And also, I completely can see the emotional damage that is caused. That is just so much deeper. It's a deeper scar when it comes to this, because it's the sadistic, torturous aspects of it are very they'll stick for life. And it's I really hope that I can continue with this study and look further into it in my own pace, when because it's hard mentally to do it. But
Well, and us victims need the help, because that's something I've really never really processed before. And now we've taken that scab off. That's painful. Yeah, that's this article that was in psychology. She came up, this psychiatrist came up with these three different categories. One was a predisposed molester that enjoys projecting and putting on that pain and that physical and sexual pain. The second category was the ones that the women have been in a position of power over children, like a teacher, a coach, something of that order. Then the third category of the molesters was those that are coerced into being part of that with either a female or a male companion. So they're kind of brought into it. Is there any other category of those three, or does that cover pretty well those female perpetrators, that it's either people that are just predisposed of and they are molesters in the most graphic way, put power over them, or they coerce in it? Are we missing any other category that could be part of the perpetration? Good
I mean,
question, huh?
those are that's a good question. They're pretty good categories. I would say one that is kind of left out is the one where it had been done to them,
Oh.
so they then perpetrate against that. There is a lot of there was a case where male prisoners that were incarcerated were interviewed, and they were asked, "Why did you commit sexual crimes against women or girls?" And they about I think 66 or 60% of them had said that it was because they had a female perpetrator that did it to them. And so it was this like cycle that was happening. And so I'm not ever going to say that someone that had been abused will become an abuser.
Right.
I am a big believer in breaking the cycles of harm and growing and learning and healing. But I am very aware that there is that cycle for those that do not heal and internalize it, and then revenge take this somewhere. And so I do know that there is a cycle that can occur. And it depends on the path the person that
That's a good
chooses
point.
to take.
I'm gonna
But
put
there
that in
might
with
be
the other
more.
category. Yeah,
Yeah, there
that's
might
that
be other
is.
categories that pop up, and I'll let you know once I do some more
Okay.
research into that.
We only have a minute or two. I want to make sure we get to talk about the conference. This topic is fascinating. We can talk about it all day. The conference that you're gonna have in Miami, quickly tell us when and where and how to get in with that information. It's just the kind of thing that we're gonna be discussing in panels and offsites and things outside of the conference and during the conference. What's it all about, the conference that you're in charge of?
Yeah, no problem. So I am so excited that we are going to have that the upcoming conference. It will be in Miami, Florida, as you had said. And so this will take place on the 11th to 13th of June. And this is called the 2024 International Conference on Violence Against Men and Boys. And so this is a groundbreaking educational and capacity building event that is designed to address the often overlooked issue of violence against men and boys. There is a focus on reframing violence as a public health issue, and this conference aims to equip the individuals that can be in the private sector, government, healthcare, social services, criminal justice, with the practical knowledge and skills necessary to prevent and respond to these various forms of violence that is experienced by males. And through this scope, we really hope to help attendees from all of these sectors explore the structural determinants and these various types of violent factors that impact mental health, physical health, education, criminal involvement in the future, revictimization, financial stability, and then public safety as well. The attendees will be guided from insight into action, which is our core theme, as we engage on these topics and perspectives. And we go into presentation, panels, stories, evidence-based research, and survivor listening sessions. And so we are really excited to go over topics such as restorative justice, firearm violence, gang violence, human trafficking. There's going to be a panel on parents, on Native youth, trans masculinity, root causes, social determinants, synthetic approaches and solutions, and so much more. And I am so excited to actually hear your presentation, Dr. Gregory Williams, and I can't wait to hear it on ACEs. And I think it fits so perfectly well with our program as we are reframing violence and trauma as a public health issue. And I am really excited about this event. And for those that are interested, they can get their tickets in person or online at http dot dot the little like slash slash a conference vamp.com. So that is conference vamb.com. So B as in bumblebee.
Right. Violence
Violence
against men
against
and boys.
men and boys. There we go.
VMB.
Yeah, or they can find me anywhere online. I'm very easily Googleable with Ana Lucia Maria Capacheco. You can find me on Linktree or on LinkedIn. Add me, and I will give you everything I can for the conference and answer any of your questions as well. But thank you so much for letting me talk about the conference a little bit. So
Oh, this is
exciting.
great. Thank you for being on the program today. I know we're out of time, but look this up. Be part of that. Even if it's the online experience, I think the knowledge is going to be premier of what people need to hear. Maybe not want to hear, but they need to hear. And all the education, all the panelists, and all the speakers are second to none. And it's going to be something that is going to be one of the biggest in the country quickly. So make sure you come and be part of that. Miami, June 11th through the 13th. We'd love to see you live right there in person. Thank you, Ina Lucia, for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank
I
you so
appreciate
much
it.
for having me.
And we'll have you back on quickly. I know we'll have you back on again. Thank you so much. As we close each and every program, I always like to let you know, no matter what we talk about, no matter what you have endured, no matter what you're going to face tomorrow, the sun's going to come up in the morning. I promise you that. It will. Just like there's always hope. Never give up on the hope. As long as there's people like Ina Lucia around, they're out there trying to fight and discover and research and help so many people. Never give up on hope. And there's always somebody there to help you. You're not in this alone. Join us right here next week for another edition of Breaking the Silence from Houston, Texas. God bless. Have an awesome week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.